Hello and welcome to this discussion on the upcoming 2020 hurricane season. I'm Louis Philippe Caron, a research scientist at the Barcelona Supercomputing Center. And with me today is Dr. Phil Klosbach, research scientist at in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University. Hello, Phil. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. And also with us is Dr. Ryan Trishelat, co-founder and chief meteorologist at Weather Tiger in Tallahassee, Florida, and also hurricane analyst for the USA Today Network. Hello, Ryan, how are you?
Hey, LP. Really looking forward to a great discussion today. Lots to talk about.
Yeah, that's true. So glad you could both be here today. There are a lot of things that I want to discuss with you both. But before we dive into the 2020 season, I'd like to just briefly get back to the 2019 season and give a shout out to our listener, Kimberly Wood from Mississippi State University. So Kim reached out after our last conversation to contribute to a manuscript that she was writing on the 2019 hurricane season. And here we are a few months later, the paper just been accepted a couple of weeks ago. So it's good that at least one person is listening to our conversation. And just to set us in the mood, Ryan, would you mind refreshing our memory on 2019 season?
Sure. Well, 2019 was a weird one. 20% of the storms produced about 80% of the activity, and just two hurricanes, Dorian and Lorenzo, accounted for 60% of the total accumulated cyclone energy, or ACE, which we'll be referring to quite a bit in this podcast, over the course of the year. It wasn't a very active year in the deep tropics. The main development region was around near normal activity. The Caribbean and Gulf were relatively quiet. It was again offset by overperformance in the subtropical Atlantic, with both Dorian and Lorenzo achieving Category 5 status in the subtropics of the Atlantic. The key impactful hurricane, of course, was Hurricane Dorian, which set the upper bound of severity for tropical cyclone impacts on a single location, with Category 4 and 5 intensity lingering for 24 hours or more over portions of the northern Bahamas. And if we go back and we look at what the forecasts were going into hurricane season 2019, there was some disagreement. We had some of the predictive metrics that we look at, Phil and I look at as we're making our forecasts, and other forecast groups do as well. They didn't necessarily point the same direction going into the 2019 season. There was an ongoing but a relatively weak El Nino to start the year. That'd be a negative. You had a relatively cool main development region, but it was trending warmer, which would be negative, but then the trend matters too. So that was a bit of a question mark. And there were very warm Atlantic subtropics like 2018. Predictors in general were calling for a normal to slightly above average season. The May-June predictions, the average ACE was 113, which is about 10% higher than the most recent average over the last 40 years. There was also some significant spread between forecast groups, which was primarily due to uncertainty about which way ENSO, El Nino or La Nina, was going to go. Final ACE wound up just over 130. So the call of a slightly above average season wound up being fairly accurate, wound up at about 70th percentile of hurricane seasons since 1950 in terms of ACE. There was some idea that September was active. August wasn't very active until you got to the last week of December. Last week of August. It was really that fourth week when Dorian developed that things took off, and things were very busy for about 6 weeks between last week of August and the first week of October. And there was some thought that October was going to be active as well. And so by that point it was neutral. The Caribbean was very warm. We were coming off 2018 where Hurricane Michael developed in the Caribbean and then raced across the Gulf and made landfall as a Category 5. So speaking as someone from North Florida, I was looking to October of 2019 with some anxiety because of Michael PTSD. But interestingly, October was relatively quiet. And the reason for that is the Indian Ocean Dipole went into a strongly positive phase. And that means the western half of the Indian Ocean, the anomalous warmth was in the western half and the eastern half was cooler relative to normal. And it was one of the strongest, if not the strongest, Indian Ocean Dipole warm events on record. And that actually wound up functioning as kind of a surrogate El Nino. as you know, while the ENSO conditions were neutral. Usually you see a positive IOD when ENSO is positive, but ENSO was neutral in this case. So you have this really unusual circumstance of the Indian Ocean being the primary driver of global climate going into fall of 2019. And because of that, El Nino years tend to be, they tend to end earlier because of increased shear across the Western Atlantic. And October activity was relatively minimal. There were a couple hybrid storms in the Gulf of Mexico, but they weren't highly impactful weather. So anyway, if you want to read more about the influence of the Indian Ocean dipole on hurricane seasons and how that's kind of an open question for more research, go ahead and check out our paper in the Geophysical Research Letters. It's just out. And shout out to our co-authors on that. Three of us were co-authors, and then also Carl Schreck, Kim Wood, and Jennifer Collins. So listen up, dear listeners, and you know, if you find something interesting about this podcast, you too may co-author a paper with us if you wish. So that's 2019 in a nutshell.
That's a great summary. Thank you, Ryan. Great plug also. Yes, please. If you have ideas, please don't be afraid to get in touch. Okay, so now today we'll be talking a lot about seasonal forecast. And just to make sure that we're all on the same page, Phil, maybe you could briefly explain to the people listening what seasonal forecasts are and what they tend to do.
Yeah, so seasonal hurricane forecasts have been around for a while now. They really got started in the early 1980s. Basically, kind of simultaneously in the Australian region, and Neville Nichols pioneered seasonal forecasting for the Southern Hemisphere, and Bill Gray at Colorado State, who founded the Atlantic Seasonal Hurricane Forecast, at CSU, my mentor and the guy who's basically started these forecasts, all the way back in 1984. This is the 37th year that our group at CSU has been doing seasonal forecasts. And so really the whole idea with seasonal forecasts is that basically what both Neville Nichols and Bill Gray found was basically a precursor signal. So basically that there was a certain set of climate conditions that tended to precede active seasons and a different set that preceded inactive seasons. And basically what they found was they both discovered that El Nino in their respective basins, so anomalously warm water in the eastern and central tropical Pacific, when you have El Nino, it tends to reduce overall levels of hurricane activity. And so Bill Gray and Neville Nichols actually had several different conversations talking about the relationship between El Nino and tropical cyclones in their respective basins. And that's interesting because effectively most other basins, especially in the Pacific Ocean, when you have an El Nino, you tend to get more hurricane activity. But in the Atlantic and near Australia, you get less hurricane activity. So this was kind of one of the first basically statistical relationships that was discovered. And then what you did is then take these kind of statistical relationships and try to untangle the physics as to why something going on in the tropical Pacific Ocean would impact hurricanes. And so obviously in the case of the Atlantic, one of the things that Bill Gray discovered is that when you had El Nino conditions, it tended to increase upper level westerly winds in the Atlantic. And canonically, your low level winds blow out of the east, the winds near the surface of the ocean, the trade winds blow out of the east. So when you have strong upper level westerly winds, that means you have a shear in the vertical. So low level winds blowing one direction, upper level winds blowing another direction. And that strong shear tends to tear apart hurricanes as they're trying to develop and to intensify. And so Bill Gray, when he did his first seasonal forecast paper, noted that relationship with El Nino, and that was one of the fundamental predictors that he used, and we still use today. Obviously, there's a lot of other predictors that our group at CSU, Ryan's group, and others use as well. We obviously monitor also very closely what's going on in the Atlantic Ocean, whether the water temperatures are warmer than normal, whether the pressures are lower than normal. And then also, as Ryan mentioned too, we look at the Indian Ocean dipole. That's very strongly positive. That can tend to cause a lot of sinking motion in the Atlantic and squelch hurricane season. So we've been using these kinds of historical relationships and statistical models for quite a while doing seasonal forecasting. Something that Bill Gray did not have available or Neville Nichols had available in the early 1980s that we do now is climate models. Climate models were really in their infancy in the early 1980s, and that's just because simply the computational power was a whole lot less than what we have now. Now we can actually use climate models to forecast large-scale conditions several months into the future. And they're not going to necessarily work perfectly. You know, a climate model June 1st can't say August 27th is going to, you know, rain in Texas or something like that with much skill. But what they can do is they can predict monthly averages, seasonal averages with reasonable levels of skill. So there's a couple of different techniques that have been used. One is what's known as a statistical dynamical hybrid model. And so what that does is you use a climate model to forecast the large scale conditions, say the vertical wind shear and the sea surface temperatures, and then you relate how typically vertical wind shear and sea surface temperatures relate to hurricane activity. A different approach that some seasonal forecast techniques use is they simply count the vortices or the hurricanes in the dynamical model during the course of the season. So typically, if the shear is low, the model predicts shear to be low, they're going to be more overall hurricanes in the model. So there's a variety of these different techniques that are used today with the seasonal forecast. And if you're really interested in seasonal forecasting, obviously Ryan and I do seasonal forecasting, but there's over 20 groups submitting seasonal hurricane forecasts for the Atlantic Basin alone to our website, seasonalhurricanepredictions.org, which is a website that Louis-Philippe and I and others have collaborated on that displays all the publicly available seasonal forecasts done by credentialed meteorologists and climatologists for the Atlantic Basin. So if you really want to see everything about seasonal forecasting, we invite you to check out that website.
All right, thanks, Phil. You mentioned Neville Nichols making forecasts in Australia. And what I found out through you recently, actually, in writing our BAMS paper, is that actually he started before Bill Gray doing this, I think. But he didn't dare, I think he was a bit hesitant to publish it. He was doing his presentation at the Bureau, but because there was so much skepticism on seasonal forecasts itself at the time, he didn't put it in a publication. So he was just doing this in a formal way to grow. So that seems like that was not that long ago, but I guess it's a time where seasonal forecasts were not quite widely accepted.
Yeah, and I was going to comment too, just Bill Gray, he was certainly never very shy. He always had, one of his favorite quotes that he had in his office was from Babe Ruth. And he said, I hit him big or I miss him big. That was always Bill Gray's philosophy, was that, you know, if he had an idea, he would just go for it and put it out. But one thing I will say is that Neil Frank, who was the director of the National Hurricane Center in the early 1980s, was a longtime friend of Bill Gray. And Bill Gray had also been doing, you know, fundamental hurricane research for nearly 30 years at that point. So he had a pretty good credibility record, such that when he started doing seasonal forecasting, he was already a very well-known figure in the field. It wasn't like it was some, you know, new person in the field who was completely unknown starting these seasonal forecasts. So I think that helped in terms of his credibility when he started putting these forecasts out. But certainly they were met with skepticism then, and I think they're still met with skepticism now, even in the 37th year we've been putting these out.
Yeah, no doubt. But yeah, the overall perception is quite different. I think it's been a lot of changes in these last 40 years. So we'll move on. Now that we know what seasonal forecasts are, we will just move on. But before we look at the forecast for this year, at the time of recording, which is June 15, we've already had three tropical storms. We've had Arthur, Berta, and Cristobal, which is quite high. Meteorologically speaking. So should we be worried about this? Is that a signal that we're going to have an active season? Yeah, Ryan?
Sure. Well, you know, yeah, there's a lot of course, anxiety towards the 2020 hurricane season, given the state of planet Earth these days. But the good news is that there's a weak to no relationship between early season tropical cyclone activity and how active the entire season is. And if you calculate the correlation between activity that came before and the amount of activity that comes after, that correlation is actually not significant at a 95% confidence level until about the first week of August. And in fact, not only is that relationship not significant in June and July, it's actually right at zero. So there's really no historical relationship whatsoever between preceding ACE and following ACE. I will say, as a caveat, I have also looked at years in which there were two tropical storm landfalls early in the season. And that is a little more worrisome. I'm not sure if it holds up as in terms of statistical significance, but there's been 27 years where there were two or more tropical storm landfalls prior to July 31st. And this year, we've already seen Bertha in late May, and Cristobal in early June. So we already are at two tropical storms. Cristobal was actually the first, the earliest sea storm ever when it formed on June 2nd, I guess, is when Cristobal got its name. Anyway, if you look at those years where there's been landfalls early, you tend to have an additional roughly three tropical storm, two hurricanes, and around one major hurricane landfall in August and after in those early years where there's two landfalls prior to in June and July. So that's about 150% of normal. So it is a little worrisome that we're maybe hinting at a pattern where activity is close or threatens the continental U.S. But overall, you know, there's been years that have been very active in June and July, and just, you know, very little happened in the main part of the season in August, September, and October.
Okay, thanks, Ryan. Phil, is there something you'd like to add to this?
No, I think what Ryan said is good. I mean, basically, I guess the one thing I will chime in on is that one thing we do find is that if you get storms in the eastern and central tropical Atlantic, especially east of the Leeward and Windward Islands in June, especially in July, because that's very rare in June, but in July, that's typically a harbinger of a really, really active season. And that's because typically the eastern and central tropical Atlantic in June and July is very quiet. And that's basically due to the fact that the thermodynamics are not very conducive. There's a lot of dry air. Talk about the African dust, a lot of dry air. And it's also just tends to be the waters tend to be fairly cold. So if you get storm activity early there, that tends to be a harbinger of a very active season, just because it means overall your thermodynamics are more conducive in the eastern and central tropical Atlantic early. But it's more of a sufficient condition than a necessary one. There have certainly been many years that had very little storm activity in June and July, even in the eastern, especially in the eastern and central Atlantic, that became very active seasons. And probably the most recent example, I think that's a really good example, is 2004. We didn't get our first named storm until August 1st in 2004, and that was Hurricane Alex. And obviously, as everyone remembers, 2004 was a very, very active season, especially for the U.S. Four very significant hurricanes impacting the state of Florida.
And then if you look at 2005 exactly is what Phil's talking about here. You had Dennis and Emily develop in July, and these were, you know, classic, long-tracking, you know, these are easterly waves. That developed into, you know, a category 4 for Dennis and Cat 5 for Emily. And, you know, that was, you know, that set the tone for the rest of 2005. As a counterpoint to that, though, I'm going to trigger Phil by bringing up 2013, because there were a couple of early season tropical storms in the eastern Atlantic in 2013 that were just tropical storms, but you know, then 2013 was a very quiet year in the heart of the season. So sometimes you do get kind of freak storms that don't mean much. The most recent one was in 2018. We had a tiny little hurricane named Beryl, and it was extremely small. And 2018 was above average season, but it wasn't a big year for the tropics. So, you know, we probably shouldn't overinterpret what goes on in the eastern Atlantic unless you're really seeing those peak season conditions showing up and getting majors and, you know, in the eastern and central Atlantic early in the year.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, basically, there's a reason why, you know, instead of looking at the number of storms, we look at the large scale conditions, because like you said, especially with a storm like Beryl, I mean, it was this tiny storm that probably prior to satellite, we might not even have known it was there. You know, this tiny little thing on image. And like you mentioned, 2013, we had a couple of kind of weak anemic named storms during July. And the entire season was complete garbage. And I suspect the 2013 hurricane season will show up again, because we forecast 9 hurricanes June 1st in 2013. And we ended up with 2 hurricanes. So not a banner forecast, about as good as my prediction. Let's see, in 2018 at the San Francisco Giants were going to win the World Series. So, you know, not a banner prediction, either one.
Well, everybody's seasonal forecast busted in 2018. So, you know, don't take it personally.
All right. So speaking of forecasts, so before we start discussing what they're actually saying for this year, Phil, could you tell us what is the scale of seasonal forecasts for this time of year?
Yeah, and so, you know, overall, the June forecast I would characterize as having moderate levels of skill. We've been doing it since 1984, And so I look back at historically the average error from a June forecast, and it's about 2 hurricanes. So for example, our forecast this year is 9 hurricanes, but the error bar is about 2 if you look historically at the averages. So on average, it's about 7 to 11. So, you know, certainly not perfect, but there is some moderate levels of skill there, again, about plus or minus 2 hurricanes. So, you know, something I would say, we can give you more information. It's better than just a blind guess, but there certainly is still some uncertainty with the June forecast. By the time we do the August forecast, the correlations and the error uncertainties go down because obviously we're closer to the peak of the hurricane season. We do, one thing I think we kind of alluded to already, but just is that while the hurricane season is officially 6 months long, June and July typically are very quiet. About 95% of all your major hurricane activity occurs after the 1st of August, which is why most groups do a final seasonal forecast update around the 1st of August, because you're right prior to when the hurricane season really ramps up, but you still have the meat of the hurricane season to go.
Yeah, and if you go back and you look at the historical skill of the groups that have been putting out operational numbers for decades, you know, Bill's group at Colorado State among them, you know, you do definitely see positive skill in the ultimate rubber meets the road test of putting, you know, predictions out in public and having them verify. So, you know, I would say that, given the historical record, we are better as seasonal forecasters at this stage than guessing for sure. But at this lead time, you can certainly still be wrong.
Okay, and we'll get back to this later about how we could be wrong for this year. But now I think maybe we can discuss what the seasonal forecasts are predicting for this year. So Phil, do we have a consensus?
Yeah, so as I mentioned briefly before, Lou Philippe and I, we spearheaded a website, seasonalhurricanepredictions.org, and we have, I think we're at 26 groups now, maybe 27, that are contributing members to our website. Not all of them do all the different metrics, so we ask for a forecast of named storms, hurricanes, major hurricanes, the Category 3s and aboves, and ACE. But right now, we have 22 different groups that have submitted hurricane forecasts, so predicting the total number of hurricanes. And the average of these forecasts is for 9 hurricanes, which is the same as our group at CSU is forecasting. That's 50% more than the average hurricane season. In general, there's actually pretty high consensus between the forecasts. I think that's somewhat to be expected, though, because as Ryan alluded to, in 2019, there was a lot of uncertainty with El Nino, how strong it was going to be, would it persist? Whereas this year, I think, you know, the odds of El Nino this year are incredibly small. We'll talk about that later. And I think there's just general consensus, broad consensus among what the climate patterns are going to look like. So I think overall, I would say, yes, there is consensus this year. But again, just because there's consensus doesn't mean that that's the way things are going to turn out. And as we already briefly talked about, the 2018 hurricane season turned out less active than we anticipated. And unlike some years where you have basically the large-scale conditions turn out differently than you expect, 2018, we actually got kind of what we expected, and we ended up with more overall hurricane activity. It was what we would call an overachieving hurricane season. And some of that was, as Ryan mentioned, it was a very active subtropics in 2018. But there is just uncertainty. Even if you know perfectly what the large-scale conditions are like during the peak months of the hurricane season, say August through October, there is still some uncertainty how that's going to play out. You know, even perfect knowledge of the season does still leave uncertainty because you're trying to forecast weather events on seasonal timescale. So I think that's important that there is inherent uncertainty with these forecasts. Even 100 years from now, if we were talking seasonal forecasting, there's still going to be uncertainty with these kinds of forecasts, just given basically trying to forecast weather events on a climate timescale.
Yeah, you can have perfect knowledge of the aggregate conditions, but every hurricane is an individual event, and there is certainly a big role of luck to how individual storms play out.
Yeah, to go back to the consensus, it seems that this year there is more agreement than in previous year on the website, except for one exception. I think everybody's predicting above average, and I don't recall we have ever had anything like this. I don't know what's your feeling, Phil.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. There's really good consensus. I think it's because the last couple of years, There was more uncertainty with ENSA. I think this year, because the odds of El Nino are very low and the Atlantic is fairly warm and trending warmer, and I'm sure we'll talk about that more later, I think that does give some increased confidence in the above average seasonal forecast. But as you did note, there are some outliers. And the big outlier is the European Center, the ECMWF, the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasts, which is a dynamical model. So that's, when we talked about the seasonal forecast earlier, we talked about the various different approaches that are used. And so the ECMWF basically runs their climate model forward in time. And then what they do is they basically just count the hurricane vortices in their model, and that's their seasonal forecast. And so their forecast is for an average to slightly below average hurricane season this year. But I will note that ECMWF has been notoriously low the last few years. So there is that to be taken into account. For whatever reason, their model isn't spinning up as many vortices as we're actually getting. But certainly they obviously are top of the line dynamical weather forecast, dynamical forecast. So, you know, certainly there is still the potential that, you know, maybe Ryan and I and a lot of these other groups are too high this year. So obviously we'll be able to talk a lot more coherently about who did the best when we reconvene in 5 months or so.
Yeah, you know, as a seasonal forecaster, anytime you look at clustering a forecast, it always makes you a little bit nervous. But, you know, one thing I would say about the Euro projection, like Phil says, it's been biased very low over the last 4 years or so. And if you look at how the operational Euro, the one that goes out 10 days and makes a weather forecast, how that sometimes can play out. The operational Euro has been a little bit stingy on tropical storm genesis in the model in some cases in the past few years. I'm thinking about Dorian, where the GFS actually locked onto Dorian developing much earlier than the Euro did. And, you know, generally the skill of the GFS is a little bit lower than the Euro globally in terms of steering patterns. So whenever the GFS gets a win in, it's kind of like, you know, Rocky lands a punch on Apollo. But in this case, that kind of that maybe bias away from being aggressive on Genesis is that you see in the operational Euro kind of aggregates up to the level of their seasonal projection. And it's just, it kind of is, you know, like as Phil says, this is a, you know, I'm not a dynamicist or a modeler, so don't at me. But, you know, it is kind of that longer range run of the European model, you know, going out forward 3 or 6 months and doing that many, many times and looking at the aggregate, you know, counting the vortices that show up. So if there's a bias against the vortices showing up, you'll get these, you know, you may get a little bias in seasonal forecasting.
What I found interesting, Phil, is that you're in your new forecast system now, you do take into account ECMWF forecast you have an hybrid model with the ECMWF system as an input, and you get quite of a different answer, no? than what they get by just counting the vortices.
Yeah, that's correct. So one technique that we do at CSU, thanks very much to your help and others in Barcelona, at the Barcelona Supercomputing Center for crunching the numbers, we do basically one of those hybrid statistical dynamical models. So we forecast the inputs to our August model, so our July large-scale conditions. And when we use the ECMWF forecast of the large scale conditions for July, our forecast for the season is actually quite high, so much higher than what the dynamical model is saying. And so some of that might just be the areas that we're looking at, might not be what we're looking at is large scale conditions during the month of July and how that relates with hurricane activity during the peak of the season, which may be somewhat different from what the model's getting for August through October. And also, you know, there may just be some issues with the model tending to run a little low. In terms of the overall vortices that it's spinning up, given the large-scale conditions. I mean, you look even at 2017, I think ECMWF came out with like a total of 6 hurricanes that year or something. And obviously 2017 was one of the most active seasons on record.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see at the end of the season to compare these two methods. You start from the same model, but you get totally different answers. So to go back to the forecast themselves, so both you, Ryan at Weather Tiger, and Phil at CSU, you're both producing forecasts. Where does your forecast fit with respect to the rest of the pack?
Sure. Well, Weather Tiger's forecast for the upcoming hurricane season, it's a pretty aggressive forecast. We're calling for approximately 19 tropical storms, 8 hurricanes, and 5 major hurricanes, with accumulated cyclone energy of 180 units. I would say that we are on the high side of the consensus envelope, but within the consensus. We're just a little higher than Phil's numbers at Colorado State. So, you know, again, a very active season, and, you know, Phil does this too, but we always put out probabilistic guidance for a range, a chance that we fall within a certain range. So we see about a 50% chance that we fall within the 140 to 210 ACE unit range, which basically means that there is a 75% chance or more of there being, of the upcoming season being in the top third historically since 1950.
And what about you, Phil?
Yeah, so we're also forecasting a very active season. We're calling for a total of 19 storms, which includes the 3 that have already formed, Arthur, Bertha, and Cristobal, 9 hurricanes and 4 major hurricanes. That's a little bit of an increase from what we put out in early April. At that point, we're calling for 16 storms, 8 hurricanes, and 4 major hurricanes. The increase in number of storms was somewhat due to the 3 storms that have already formed. We did increase the number of hurricanes from 8 to 9, just given the overall the large-scale conditions, I would say, have tended looking more conducive for an active hurricane season. And I think even since the forecast we put out around the 1st of June, I'd say large-scale conditions have continued to look even a little bit more conducive for an active season. So, you know, we'll be updating our forecast again early July, and then the final update in early August. And so there may be potential to increase these forecasts a little bit more. Just to compare, so Ryan's ACE was 180, and the long-term median is around 95. Ours is 160, so again, pretty close overall with overall ACE for the 2020 season. One thing Ryan did point out is we do also do probabilistic forecasts, and both of our groups, I think, are doing a more rigorous method of calculating them this year with probabilities of exceedance. So with 2018, as I mentioned briefly before, with the 2018 hurricane season, you know, it was basically end up with more activity than what we expected. And so Mark Saunders from the University College London and I and a couple of colleagues wrote a paper on the 2018 season, and basically we advocated pretty strongly for calculating probabilities of exceedance. So basically calculating what are the odds that a hurricane season that say is going to have 4 or more hurricanes, 5 or more hurricanes. So even with 2018, while it was a much more activity than we expected, there was about a 5% chance that the hurricane season would have as much activity as it had given the observed large scale conditions. And Ryan was actually one of the reviewers on that paper. And so all 3 of us now are using probabilities of exceedance with our forecast to help kind of quantify, I think in a more rigorous manner, the overall uncertainties associated with these forecasts. So we try to put out our best estimate, but I think it's important to quantify the uncertainties. And so typically the ranges of the forecasts shrink as you get closer to the forecast because there's more confidence in the predictions.
Yeah, I think formulating in a probabilistic manner, I think, is quite important.
Right, and especially because there's, you know, when it comes to Atlantic hurricane seasons, you have a fat tail going out into hyperactivity. So if you just give a mean, or even just give the most likely outcome, you're not really giving the full information of what the season might look like, because with that fat tail going out to 200-250%. Of a normal season, you kind of need to give the information that you wind up in that, you know, in that range to really give people a sense of what may happen. If you look at our exceedance curve at WeatherTiger, I mean, this is not a forecast, but if you look at the exceedance curve, which is calibrated against our errors in forecasting and real-time errors going back 30 years, there's roughly a 10 or 12% chance that 2020 will be the most active hurricane season of all time. Which is about 250 ACE units. So, you know, again, not a forecast. That's something that's, you know, a 10 or a 12% chance of tail risk. But, you know, that's the power of the exceedance curve, is that you basically, you know, we've always reported a confidence interval, you know, 50% chance we land here, 80% chance we land between here and here. But if you look at the full, reporting the full, you know, exceedance curve allows you to take a look at, you know, basically the probability of exceeding any point, any amount of activity that you want to.
So to go back to the forecast, so we've talked about it a bit, about the conditions, but maybe we can expand a little bit on Phil, starting with you, Phil. So can you maybe walk us through why you're forecasting an active season, maybe starting with Enzo?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a few factors when it comes to the hurricane season. And as you mentioned, ENSO is a big one. We're currently in neutral ENSO conditions, which means neither El Nino nor La Nina. But if you look at the weekly sea surface temperature anomalies, we're closer to La Nina than we are to El Nino. And so the difference, the official definition of La Nina or El Nino is half a degree Celsius, which is, you know, a little less than 1 degree Fahrenheit, which seems, you know, who cares? 1 degree doesn't seem like it's very much. But in the deep tropics, 1 degree Celsius, or half a degree Celsius is a big deal. That makes a big difference in how the atmosphere then responds. And so right now, we may not officially be at the El Nino, the La Nina threshold for the peak of the season, but I think we're certainly going to probably be on at least on the cool side of neutral and maybe to the official La Nina threshold. One thing that's important to note is that, you know, it's more than just what the atmospheric temperatures, the oceanic temperatures are, it's how the atmosphere then responds. And so a case in point of this is the 2017 Atlantic hurricane season. It wasn't officially a La Nina event, but we wrote a paper on the 2017 hurricane season, and one of the things we looked at was the Walker circulation, which is a tropical atmospheric circulation. And so when that circulation is running strongly, that tends to be very typically what you expect in La Nina conditions. And it was an extremely strong Walker circulation in 2017, especially during September, which was the most active September on record in 2017. So it's more than just the oceanic temperatures, it's how the atmosphere then responds. And so the atmosphere responds both just to what's going on in the tropical Pacific, but then also what's going on in the other oceanic basins as well. And I think, you know, whether you necessarily have the La Nina threshold or you're just on the cool side of neutral, both of these have historically been recipes generally for an active hurricane season, if other climate factors are also tending that direction.
Right. I've taken a look just stratifying how the hurricane season turned out based on how August and September ENSO state was, and really weak Nina and neutral negative conditions are both pretty favorable. They've both produced on average hurricane seasons that are around 130% of normal, just naively not knowing what else is going on in the Atlantic or elsewhere in the world. If the only thing you knew was August, September, ENSO state, you would guess that either weak Nina or neutral negative would both provide generally favorable conditions and a higher chance of an active season. And yeah, you know, I mean, and the reason why that sets up is you've got, you know, 2017, you had this what's called a standing wave, where you just had this region of anomalous rising air over East Africa and over the Indian Ocean. You had anomalous sinking air over the Pacific, and then you kind of had another rising couplet over the Western Atlantic. So that's, you know, September 2017, you packed a season and a half worth of normal activity into 1 month. And, you know, you were juicing the tropical waves coming off of Africa with the rising branch over East Africa. And then you were providing a favorable upper level dynamical environment near the United States with that other rising branch over Central America and Eastern North America. So that's, you know, that's kind of the mechanism by which that works and that matters. And it doesn't always set up as persistently as it did in 2017. 2017 is kind of the maximum case for that, you know, standing wave being in exactly the wrong position to produce a lot of damaging impacts on the U.S.
So for your model, Ryan, you're considering ENSO to be a favorable condition for this year, no?
Yes. And you know, when you're looking at May-June forecast, most of the historical skill comes from capturing ENSO state. You know, the Atlantic can change in June and July and August. The Pacific can change too, but once you get through what's called the spring predictability barrier, where the Pacific can and does change more rapidly in the spring, it tends to persist. What you have in the early summer for El Nino or La Nina, there's more of, you know, there's more oceanic memory there than anywhere else. And that's kind of where the skill that we have in making seasonal forecasts early in the summer arises from. So, you know, we're looking at the same neutral negative or weak Nina conditions that Phil and other groups are looking at. And, you know, that's certainly starting us off at a place where, you know, we're more likely to be above normal. And then on top of that, we're also adding in generally favorable conditions in the Atlantic.
Yeah, so maybe you can talk a bit more about this. Yeah, the conditions in the Atlantic, right?
Sure. So we do have the regions that matter in late spring and early summer that have a positive relationship, warmer temperatures, of the ocean waters lead to a statistical relationship with more activity later in the season. Tends to be basically this kind of arc from northern Brazil to Western Europe and then curving towards Greenland. This is sort of a horseshoe of doom that shows up in some of the more active years in the historical data set. So we have seen some pretty significant warming across the tropical Atlantic in April and May, and we are generally warmer than average in that main development region and off the North African and Western European coast. Currently, the MDR is running just under half a degree above normal, which is, it has been warmer in the past and some other, going into some other hyperactive years, but a half a degree is a pretty significant difference. So, you know, as we're taking on the more traditional look of a warm AMO as we go into the summer months, that's another leading indicator that we're going to have a busy year ahead. And I just want to say that if you stack up years that have this kind of warm hook out of this tropical Atlantic towards Europe versus years that have a colder hook in that same area, there's about 70% more tropical cyclones in the years that have the warm AMO, that warm meat hook, versus the colder arc in the same place. So it does matter in terms of count of storms that you get developing.
Yeah, okay. So, and Phil, do you expect to have warmer than normal main development region?
Yeah. I mean, I would think at this point, as Ryan mentioned, we're running about half a degree Celsius warmer than normal there right now. I would expect that to persist. One of the reasons why is because typically, especially in June, if you look at the areas that historically correlate the highest in June with ACE for the season, so that accumulated cyclone energy, your highest correlations tend to actually be more in the subtropics and in the middle latitudes, especially in the eastern Atlantic. When you get that, as you talk about that warm hook, especially off of Western Europe, when you get warm waters off of Western Europe, so off the Iberian Peninsula in June, it tends to force a weaker subtropical high, weaker trade winds, which mean weaker mixing up of the ocean surface into the deep tropics for the peak of the season. So I would typically expect, given kind of the overall setup that we currently have, that overall I would expect to see continued basically anomalous warming of the MDR, likely probably to remain at least half a degree Celsius, if not even a little bit warmer than that, for the peak of the hurricane season, which when you combine that with cool, neutral, potentially weak La Nina event, typically is a harbinger of a well above average overall Atlantic hurricane season.
And someone mentioned warmer than average subtropics. Is that something that matters?
Yeah, I mean, I think it matters for a couple of reasons. One, as I mentioned before, when the subtropics are warm in June, that tends to force lower pressure, which then tends to help anomalously warm or cause the tropics to be warmer than average during the peak of the season. But also we've seen, especially the last couple of years, when you have a really, really warm subtropics, it does tend to help fuel some of these generally, a lot of these are fairly short-lived weak storms, but we had a lot of those short-lived weak storms last year and in 2018. But also you can have storms like Dorian that will be kind of anemic in the deep tropics and then get more into the subtropics and be able to really rapidly intensify. And I think kind of the classic case in point of that was Florence in 2018. It was kind of an anemic storm. It reached major hurricane, then got sheared and weakened back, and then actually re-intensified once it got into the subtropics in a much more conducive environment. So I think it does matter to a certain degree. Obviously, if I had to pick where the waters were warmer than normal for an active season, it matters more than deep tropics. But I think if you have a warm tropics and a warm subtropics, that can certainly help add some additional fuel to the fire, so to speak.
Okay, great. And so a region that we really haven't talked about much yet or touched at all is the Gulf of Mexico. So in early spring, the Gulf was quite warm. Ryan, is that something that we should be concerned about?
No, not the spring warmth in the Gulf of Mexico got quite a bit of attention because it was so warm relative to normal, 2 to 4 degrees Celsius, warmer than average in the Gulf in the spring. And that's really, we didn't have much of a summer of a winter in the Southeast. March and April were much warmer than normal as well. But however, if you go back and you look at the historical record and you do the spatial correlation between SSTs and the upcoming season, again, the Gulf of Mexico in March and April, there's no relationship between warmth in the Gulf and an active season up ahead. So in our initial kind of first look in April, I mentioned this in my outlook, it's alarming. I don't want this to persist into the core of the year, but this isn't something to look at right now and say, we're going to have an active season. It's a bit of a red herring. So we had, we had April and May in the Southeast, but they were in the opposite order. We had April weather in May, and May weather in April. May was unusually pleasant here in North Florida. And we had a number of frontal passages. Those frontal passages, there were northerly winds behind the front, and we have northerly winds across the Gulf that upwells cooler water from depth. So those SSTs have come back down to Earth. They're still generally a bit warmer than average across the Gulf. We did see some upwelling and cooling following Cristobal. Tropical cyclones too tend to evaporate warm water off the surface, as well as cause basically waters move radially out from the center of circulation, and you get upwelling from depth that way too. So the Gulf is we're still a little bit warmer than average, but we're much closer to normal now, and it's not a strong leading indicator in the spring.
Okay, thanks. So just shifting gear a bit, sometimes we like to look at past season, which had similar condition ahead of the hurricane season, so-called analog season. Ryan, I know you've looked at this, Phil, as well. So I'd be curious to know, Ryan, starting with you, what are your analog season for this year?
Sure. And analog methodologies, they're not the technique that we use to generate our forecast numbers or our forecast estimated errors, but they are something that we do recruit a set of optimized analogs, basically as a common sense check. We like to see if the analogs are pointing in the same direction as our more objective forecasting methodology. So if you take a look at the Atlantic Basin and you focus on the regions of the Atlantic that have the best historical relationships with the activity in the upcoming year, and then you match those going back in time as closely as you can, the 4 years that we've come up with that are relatively strong matches are 1961, 1964, 1989, and 2017. And that's a pretty worrisome quartet of years to have as your analogs. In all four of those years, May sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic had kind of a bridge of subtropical warmth that extended from the Caribbean out towards Europe. And they were also warmer than normal over the MDR and equatorial Atlantic heading into the summer months. And what you usually see in those type of years is that the warmth over the subtropics and the warmth over the equator region of the Atlantic kind of merges over the Atlantic MDR for the peak months of the season. Also, all four of those years were either cool, neutral, or already in La Nina in the Pacific. So I didn't have to toss any of those analogs because the Pacific was a bad match. If you average the ACE over those four seasons, it comes in right between 180 and 185. So, if we made forecasts based on an analog methodology, it would have been almost exactly the same number as what our objective guidance was putting out. So the fact that the analogs and our forecast are pointing in the same way is worrisome. And I'm also just to throw 1 year out there that is a particular concern. 1964 jumps out as a year where there also was significant warmth in the subtropical central Pacific. And there's some indication that that might modulate steering currents in an unfavorable way for steering hurricanes that develop in the general direction of the continental U.S. during the peak months of the hurricane season. So too far out to say, much in terms of steering at this point, but I don't like that 1964 analog showing up as a good match or a decent match for the Pacific and a good match for the Atlantic, because you had Clio, you had Isbell, you had Dora, and there was one other one that hit the Gulf too. So it was a year where you had four hurricane landfalls on the continental U.S. Hilda, there we go. That was an important one for Louisiana. So something to watch. Also, I know that the European dynamical guidance, while it's not pumping out a lot of hurricanes, it is putting a relatively strong Western Atlantic ridge in place over the Atlantic for September. Which is a pattern that would tend to steer hurricanes westward rather than recurve them out into the open Atlantic. And that's something that the Euro does well. The Euro is the best model for, medium and long range steering guidance and has the lowest errors. So I don't like the analogs that are showing up. They're active years and generally also active years that produced an outsized number of U.S. impacts as well.
Yeah, so you mentioned 1964. I think it's a year with five major hurricanes and multiple hits in Florida. So yeah, not a good year.
It was a big year. It was a big year on for the Hurricane Cleo. There was a bit of family lore in my family that my dad and my uncle, my family grew up in Miami, and my dad and my uncle supposedly threw a football in the eye of Hurricane Cleo, which came up straight up Biscayne Bay. So anyway, little bit of family lore to throw into the mix there, the 1964 analog.
Oh, maybe you can do the same this year.
Well, I'm in Tallahassee, so I don't recommend going outdoors in the eye. That would be my guidance. But
You're wise, Ryan. So for those who didn't know, 1989 also was the year for Hugo, obviously, and 2017, I guess most people remember Harvey, Irma, and Maria. Phil, what about your analogs?
Yeah, so our analogs are also somewhat different from Ryan's, but also in general very active seasons. We have 1995, 2003, 2008, 2011, 2013, and 2016. Generally, they were characterized also by warmer than normal MDR SSTs, cool, neutral to La Nina. But really, the one season out of those six that wasn't an active overall season was 2013. That's really the classic forecast bust. Certainly the worst forecast that I've ever made, or that our group at CSU has made, when we forecast 9 hurricanes in June and we ended up with 2. I suspect we'll talk a lot more about 2013 a little bit later as we start to wrap up the podcast. But 2013 was a classic underachieving season, even knowing perfectly what the large-scale conditions were like. You certainly would have still expected more overall activity than what we got. There was a lot of mid-latitude intrusions of dry air, and a lot of shear came out of the mid-latitudes that year, since overall other conditions were fairly conducive. But overall, our seasons also are, the other 5 years were all pretty active hurricane seasons, most notably 95. 2008 and 95, 2003 and 2008 were all three very very active to borderline hyperactive seasons.
You always have to have that one whammy in the analog set to keep you up at night. So yeah,
just keep us guessing a little bit. So now we're a month and a half away from the beginning of the peak of hurricane season. Could the forecast change dramatically between now and August 1st, Ryan?
Yes. I mean, you have to be aware as a seasonal forecaster that you can be very wrong and try to cover the range of outcomes that are likely by issuing probabilistic guidance. Yes, we're calling for ACE of 180, and that would be an extremely active season. 50% chance of ACE between 140 and 210. An 80% chance ACE of between 100 and roughly 260 units of ACE. So, you know, that means that there's a 75% chance that we land in the top third of seasons since 1950 in terms of ACE, when we really can start to make a decent guess of how much ACE there was based on our observational methods. But, you know, that still leaves a 25% chance of a normal or a below normal season. So why might our forecast go down? I don't think it's going to go down because of ENSO. ENSO is almost certain to be in a favorably weak Niña, cool neutral configuration. But Atlantic SSTs, they're more volatile in the summer. They can change dramatically during the summer months. And sometimes they change dramatically during the summer months in 2013 from a very favorable configuration to a very unfavorable configuration. Or sometimes you evolve in a more active direction as we did in 2018 and 2019. You do also have, you can have unpredictable jet stream patterns. If you have a persistent period of positive NAO, you can erode that Atlantic SST warmth if the trades are stronger than normal. One of the best predictors for the August forecast onward is the strength of the low-level trade winds across the Atlantic and the Caribbean, because they tend to persist between July and into the peak months of the season, but two, because if you have strong trades, you're probably eroding your SST warmth across the MDR. If you see that develop in July, that certainly could reset the odds towards a more typical year by the time we revise our forecast in August. Well, could the forecast go higher from 180? Well, it seems like we're almost pricing this to perfection right now because we're factoring in favorable Pacific and favorable Atlantic conditions. But the MDR is about half a degree Celsius above normal right now. In 2005, that was more like a degree above normal. You came into July. So if you see warming of another active year, July itself can be very active. In 2005, we did over 60 units of ACE in July alone. So if you know, you have to add what's happened to what you expect to happen to make your forecast. So, you know, if we're looking at significantly above normal, above our expectations for ACE occurs in June and July, then we're going to have to raise our numbers as well to reflect that pre-existing activity as well.
Phil, anything you'd like to add to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ryan covered it pretty well. I mean, I think really the only kind of the things we're looking at, you know, obviously, I think we're pretty, it'd be extremely unlikely to get El Nino at this point. I mean, I think if for some reason, you know, the trade winds just completely collapsed and we started seeing some anomalous warming in the tropical Pacific. If we were to see a really strongly developing positive Indian Ocean dipole, that would potentially give us pause, make us think about maybe lowering the forecast. But I think, frankly, you know, at least from our forecast of 160 ACE, I think there's probably at least from the July outlook, a higher chance of going a little bit further up than down, just given the trends in the large scale conditions, even in the last couple of weeks in general, we're seeing more warming, anomalous warming, so warming faster than average in the tropical Atlantic. So I think overall conditions are looking a little bit more conducive. One thing that Ryan mentioned too is we look very closely at the trade winds over the Caribbean and the tropical Atlantic. And typically it's around mid-June where those trade winds, the correlation with ACE starts to get really, really high. And so we'll be watching those very closely. If those trades are weaker than normal, maybe the forecasts will go up. If for some reason they're stronger than normal, the forecast might come down. So that's something we're going to be very closely monitoring here as we go into our July update and then our final update in early August.
So maybe before we close, quickly, because I think we're running a bit long here. So imagine that we're now in December and then all these, the forecasts have been a bust. And in the end, we didn't get above average, but we got normal or even below normal activity. So what could be the reason for this? Like, what could be the one factor that these forecasts missed?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, overall, you know, the big forecast that always gives me cold sweats is 2013, as I've already talked about a little bit. You know, we only ended up with two hurricanes that year, and it was basically both occurred over one weekend. So if you're on vacation that weekend, you pretty much missed the season. You know, we did have 14 storms, but a lot of these were very short-lived and weak. You know, really, really anemic overall season. And again, I think still an underachieving season. You know, it's really hard even with the large-scale conditions. If you go back to the paper that Mark Saunders and I and a couple of colleagues published got published earlier this year on the 2018 season. 2013, you plot the shear and you plot the amount of ACE. It's on the very low end of ACE given the shear that was observed. There was a lot of wave breaking, I think, from the mid-latitudes that came in that year. We don't really have a lot of predictability for that. There's actually a student in our group who's working on wave breaking and looking at predictability of it. It doesn't have a lot of predictability on a seasonal time scale, which you know, it's one of these reasons I think why when you look at these seasonal forecasts, you know, there's always going to be uncertainty and there's always going to be, you know, you're going to have forecast busts, I think, regardless. You know, with 2013, there was a pretty significant cold blob in the subtropical Atlantic, which I think may have forced an increased kind of frontal activity and promoted frontal activity into the deep tropics. You know, it's tricky to say what other factors could shut it down. You know, again, if we had a positive Indian Ocean dipole, maybe that would shut it down. If the tropical Atlantic, you know, doesn't continue to anomalously warm, if it kind of flattens out or starts to cool, maybe that could shut it down. You know, really, I would say we probably got to see something fairly soon to really cause things to especially end up below average. I mean, I think average, you know, an average season or year, like say like last year where it's a little bit above normal, I could see that probably being a more likely scenario than, you know, just a complete garbage year like we saw in 2013. Right now, things are looking reasonably conducive. But again, you know, it's tricky. You're trying to forecast weather events on a climate time scale, and very subtle things can cause big differences. I mean, I think kind of an example to me is even 2010, which was, you know, moderate La Nina and warmest Atlantic on record. You would expect, well, that would generate probably the most AC we've ever observed. And it was a very, very active season, but it really still, I think, was a bit of an underachiever given what the large scale was. But some of that was due to just, you'd have waves move off the coast of Africa and the one wave would develop and then it would shear the one behind it. There's a lot of these kind of, I guess we call stochastic or noise features that can come in and change the ACE level somewhat. So there is always going to be that uncertainty associated with these forecasts. But I'd say, again, if you don't start seeing some fairly significant changes soon, I think the odds of having another 2013 or an extremely quiet season are fairly low. Hopefully some of these additional model guidance tools that both Ryan and I have and that we have that we didn't even have in 2013, some of these other hybrid models and things will hopefully help eliminate those massive forecast busts like we saw that year.
Right. What about you, Ryan? What do you think could make your forecast go bust?
So our probabilistic guidance right now is that a year in the bottom third of historical seasons since 1950, which would be 70 ACE or less, there's only about a 5% chance of that happening. If we see that 5% chance happen, it probably means there's been a very significant change in the Atlantic sea surface temperature pattern in June and July, as in 2013. I don't think it's possible that we flip into a mode for ENSO that's truly destructive. There's a lot of colder than average water at depth across the Pacific. You know, even weaker trades, you're not going to warm very quickly in the Pacific. That's pretty much baked in. You know, if we wind up near normal, which would be between 70 and 125 ACE units, you know, that might be because the Atlantic MVR, it didn't warm as much. It would stay relatively marginal. It could also be there's some sub-seasonal forcings on the Atlantic Basin where you're talking about these waves that propagate across the global tropics, like the MJO or convectively coupled Kelvin waves. And they have, you know, they have periods of 30 to 60 days. And sometimes you get these, you know, the periods where you have constructive, you have more upper level outflow, divergence aloft, you're favoring convection over the Atlantic. That can line up in a way that it's not necessarily well-timed with easterly waves moving underneath it because of a dust outbreak or something like that. It also just might not line up well with the climatological peak of the season when the waters are warmest. You might have a destructive, you know, basically more convergent, less convection supporting regime aloft in the peak, you know, weeks of hurricane season. And really, hurricane season, the peak weeks, the 2 weeks around the historical peak on near September 10th, over a third of the season happens in a 2 week frame, right around that climate peak of the season. So if conditions don't line up for weather reasons, which can't be predicted at this range, you know, you can certainly wind up with a season that underperforms what you would have expected given the aggregate baseline conditions. And again, you know, it's individual hurricanes are individual hurricanes, and they interact with their environment in a way that ranges from the meso to the, you know, micro scale. In 2019, you know, how would the season have turned out if Dorian had continued to move west and had moved over Hispaniola and dissipated? You know, you probably would have been subtracting 30, 40 ACE units from the year just because of that one change and with one storm. Florence, what if Florence goes out to sea in 2018 and it doesn't track along 25 north from, you know, 50 west all the way, you know, up to the Carolina coast? Again, you're subtracting out 30 or 40 units of ACE because of one synoptic scale interaction with the TC steering environment. So, you know, single storm idiosyncrasies and unpredictable sub-seasonal, you know, interactions can certainly modulate where you land. And that can really, you're capturing that to some extent, the inherent uncertainty with your, you know, with your expected error intervals. But, you know, things with a 1 in 5 or a 1 in 4 chance of occurring, you know, they're not uncommon. You know, no one would ever win a scratch-off ticket if a 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 thing didn't turn out. So that's why we forecast probabilistically, because I'm going to quote, and by quoting Shakespeare, the wise man knows himself to be a fool, and false confidence in seasonal forecasting is a fool's errand, to be sure.
Okay, well, I think we can leave it to Shakespeare then. Let me try to top him. So we're going to leave it here, I think. There's probably a lot more we could talk about, but we can save it for, yeah, when we reconvene, maybe in November. So before we wrap up, let me just thank my guest. Thank you, Phil. You can find the CSU seasonal forecast at www.tropical.colostate.edu. And you can also find Phil on Twitter at Phil Klosbach.
Not only does Phil have great TC content, but he also posts great photos from his trail runs, some screensaver level stuff coming from at Phil Klotzbach. So
okay. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
And also thank you to Ryan. You can find Ryan on Twitter at WX underscore Tiger. Ryan, would you like to say a few words again on Weather Tiger?
Sure. So if you're interested in more information on our 2020 hurricane outlook, please just go to weathertiger.com and you'll get a nice pop-up that'll just give you a direct link to our seasonal forecast. We do all sorts of weather consulting, ranging from forensic meteorology to custom seasonal forecast modeling, probabilistic guidance for basically whatever your business is, whatever greases the wheels of your enterprise and is your weather risk, and we'll design a seasonal forecast model for you that's targeted to that risk. So if that sounds like something that could help your enterprise do its job more effectively, please email me at ryan@weathertiger.com and we'll get started.
And finally, just a reminder that you can find all the seasonal hurricane forecasts for the Atlantic Basin at www.seasonalhurricanepredictions.org. And thank you again, both. And we make sure that we check back in November and to see how this all played out. So thanks again, and have a good day.